Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the showdown on the streets of Egypt between the Islamist supporters of President Morsi and opposition protesters, many of whom fought to topple the military dictator 2 years ago, only to be shut out of the revolution they brought about. Sheila Carapico, who was recently a visiting professor in political science at American University in Cairo, joins us to discuss Egypt's polarization and paralysis that might lead to the military stepping back into power. Then we'll examine the reasons behind the doubling of interest rates from 3.4 to 6.8% on federal student loans set to go into effect on Monday following the failure of the Congress to agree. House Republicans insist on tying the rates to U.S. Treasuries with a cap of 8.5%, while Senator Elizabeth Warren's proposal to set rates at 0.75%, which is what big banks pay for money from the Federal Reserve, didn't even make it to the Senate floor. David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republican Report and the founding director of Campus Progress, joins us to discuss a dysfunctional government making money off the backs of indentured students. Then finally, we will get an analysis of the much-heralded Senate immigration bill passed Thursday, with congratulations heaped upon the so-called Gang of Eight, whose exercise in bipartisanship drove an $8 billion bill up to $40 billion for additional border security that one of the bill's sponsors, Senator Corker, called overkill. Antonio Gonzalez, president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, joins us to examine a punitive and pork-laden House bill that House Republicans deem dead on arrival. And joining us now is Dr. Sheila Carapico, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, where she researches the political economy of development with special emphasis on Arab countries. Recently, she was a visiting professor in the political science department at the American University of Cairo. She's the author of Political Aid, Democracy Promotion, and the Paradoxes of Empowerment. And her forthcoming book is Political Aid and Arab Activism, Democracy Promotion, Justice, and Representation. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sheila Carapico.
Nice to speak with you again.
And what's the sense of this standoff in Egypt? And it's all over the country in all the major cities, massive protests for and against President Morsi. He is sort of urging his people to come out and support him. At the same time, he's telling the protesters that they should listen to the voices of wisdom. Is that likely to work?
No, I'd say it's probably unlikely to work, particularly since he doesn't seem to manage to speak in a voice of wisdom himself. I mean, he gave this long-winded speech earlier this week, which, you know, many people were criticizing everything from his grammar to his word choice to his, you know, kind of scolding tone. And, you know, in addition, I mean, a number of the decisions he's made have not seemed to be wisely thought through. And then, of course, you know, there's, I mean, problems particularly with electricity and water and traffic and fuel and, you know, other essential services. So when he tries to represent the voice of authority and then also of wisdom, I think a lot of people are responding kind of with derision and sneers and laughter and kind of typical Egyptian jokes. But at the same time, I mean, there's a real standoff, and people are extremely tense and worried about how the excuse me, the next few days will play out.
So is he – he is he's probably one of the most conservative of the – I think the three Islamist candidates that represented the Muslim Brotherhood. And my sense is that he's quite autocratic, and he is really quite fundamentalist. Is that his problem? Is that he the arrogance and the sense of authority that he has over as if the Egyptian people that don't agree with him are errant children? Is that a product of his religiosity?
You know, I'm not convinced that it is really a product of his religiosity. I mean, I think a lot of Egyptians, to a lot of Egyptians, it seems that Morsi imagined that he would be elected to be the new dictator. So there would be an election, and a new leader would be chosen, but would then basically take up Mubarak's power. And so he has, of course, alienated, you know, everyone except for his dwindling base, and doesn't seem to have any sense that, I mean, he and his supporters say, well, we've been elected, and so now we make the decisions, and the rest of you just shut up. And that's, I think, not exclusively Islamist or ideological in the sense that certainly Mubarak was secular and very different, but had the same, you know, attitude, I'm in charge, I don't need, you know, any input from the public. So I think it goes beyond his ideological background to kind of deep-seated problems in the Egyptian body politic. But if you go back to 2.5 years ago when the, you know, the slogan was Ishab Yurid Iskat An-Nizam, which we all translated correctly as the people want the downfall of the regime, but that last word, Nizam, also means the system. And he's very much taken back the system of absolute presidential power. And, of course, that's exacerbated by the fact that there's no functioning parliament. So it's really a problem of someone who imagines himself to have been elected dictator.
So, again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sheila Karapikos, a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, and she was recently a visiting professor in the political science department at the American University of Cairo. Now, it's at this point, the police, of course, are pretty much pro-Mubarak, and they're kind of furious about this government of Morsi, and they're certainly not going to try and crack heads on his behalf. That's my understanding. And then you've got the military, who are being quite coy, calling for restraint, but at the same time not doing anything. And so it sort of feels like a bit of a free for all. You've got Morsi's people out there, and if he gets a little bit too paranoid and or too autocratic and starts unleashing them on the protesters, it could get really nasty, couldn't it?
Well, indeed it could, and indeed it may. I mean, the police, as you say, they're not willing to fight either for Morsi or, you know, on behalf of the protesters who seem to them, perhaps rightly, to have been the people who kind of stripped them of their power a couple of years ago. And so the police and then the security forces, in other words, the police is actually a large and complicated group in and of themselves, but they don't seem to be up for the task of crowd control or violence mitigation. And then the military, you know, still managed to maintain a fairly popular image among the Egyptian public as the kind of neutral arbiters of state power. And so they have at least the potential to intervene. I mean, they also have the potential at least to kind of try to separate warring factions or nearly warring factions like the Brotherhood. And then, you know, a few of the protesters are also, you know, are armed and come looking for a fight. I mean, that's certainly not true in the majority, but there is an element there. So the military could, you know, either try to do things like surround squares to prevent violence from breaking out, or they could stage, you know, an outright coup. But as you say, I think they're being rather coy, and it's particularly difficult to read their intentions from their public statements, which in any case are rather limited.
So, Sheila Karapiko, what then is the role of the Salafists, who came in second in the Egyptian parliamentary elections that caught everybody by surprise, second to the Brotherhood? And most analysts suggest that they're disproportionately fueled by Saudi and Qatari money that gave them this political win out of nowhere. What role are they taking in all of this?
Well, the Salafis, I mean, they did seem to come out of nowhere in the sense that most Egyptians or Egyptian watchers prior to the uprising against Mubarak, or for the past 20 years, kind of grouped them under the Brotherhood or under the Islamist banner, while at the same time Saudi money, in particular, I think much more than Qatari, has been known, from Indonesia through Nigeria, has funded Salafi mosques and schools and teachings and preachings. And so, clearly Salafists had existed within the Egyptian Islamist movement for a long time. But most people were surprised that they managed to form a party and then to win significant numbers of votes so quickly. Whereas the Brotherhood, of course, is, very long-standing, established opposition party in Egypt, a known entity in some ways. But the Salafists, who are very fundamentalist, they're the real die-hard fanatics, who are almost certainly in the vanguard of attacks on Christians and recently on Shia.
They murdered those four Shia, right?
They murdered those four Shia. Right. And they're extremely sectarian in that way. They're very ideologically Sunni, much, much more than the Brotherhood. They've been attacking liquor stores. You can't spot the men quite so easily by what they're wearing, although they're increasingly kind of blatant in wearing things that would identify them as Salafis. But the women, you can more or less see them visually, who they are.
Why do you see them that way? What do they look like?
The women, one of the marks of mostly Salafis would be beyond the full veil, face, everything, wearing gloves. Mm. So, in other words, not an inch of skin showing anywhere. The men tend to wear these kind of culotte things, kind of short pants with then a short white robe over it, and sometimes the characteristic beard without a mustache. So you see the women, that women's garb, much more than you see that men's garb, at least in Cairo. Now, in some places, in some other communities in Egypt, other cities and particularly small towns, I think they're rather more blatant. And, this is a movement which, as we say, has been funded for a very long time by Saudis, and it's not even clear whether it's the Saudi government itself or individuals within the royal family or individual, billionaires or millionaires who have money to give away. And the Salafis, are not supporting the Brotherhood. So that's almost, a 5th column that could go either way. Presumably in a fight with the secularists, they might side with the Brotherhood, but that's not so clear. So they are a force, I think, sowing sectarianism and chaos, and they're one of the dangerous elements that Morsi can't control either.
And in terms of the liberals, the secularists, the ones that brought about the revolution that feel shut out from it, they, of course, many of them boycotted the elections, which, of course, made it almost certain that the Muslim Brotherhood would win. Are they going to get their act together and be more cohesive? And they seem to suffer from the traditional problems of the political left of factionalism.
Well, the boycott of the election, just briefly on that, the last two candidates were Morsi and, and a holdover from the security forces, Shafiq. And so for many, liberals, progressives, intellectuals, secularists, that wasn't a viable choice at all. And so not voting, did make sense in a certain way. It was an extremely difficult vote for any progressive intellectual or members of the labor union movement to make that choice, because it was really between two forms of reactionism, two extreme right-wing candidates. Now, I do think that of course, you're correct that they're divided or amongst themselves and sometimes even within themselves. So there are those who, this movement to get 15 million signatures to say that Morsi needs to resign and there should be new elections. And, you know, in other words, go back to the streets and force another regime change. And then there are others who, you know, take a kind of little bit more, I don't know, perhaps one might say almost armchair view of the thing, which is, okay, but there is an electoral process and, you know, now we need to work on getting parliament reelected and working on the constitution and so forth. So there's considerable disarray in the movement that brought down Mubarak to begin with.
So what's then, if you have this situation that we're not entirely sure of how it's going to be resolved, and it's very much in flux, and you've got the military sort of waiting in the wings, calling for restraint. I mean, the defense minister is a general, is he not?
Mm-hmm.
What's your sense? And clearly, one of the things that you find throughout the Arab world and in Iran in particular are these the Iranians have a word in Farsi, the hidden hand. There's so many conspiracy theories throughout the Middle East about who's behind the Syrian war, who's behind the troubles in Egypt, and invariably it's the U.S. But my understanding is the U.S. doesn't know what the hell to do here. I mean, do they? What's your sense of what the embassy in Cairo is trying to do, and what Secretary of State Kerry is trying to do?
Well, I mean, the rumor in Egypt is, I mean, completely that the U.S. is backing Morsi and the Brotherhood. And it's, I mean, going around in Cairo, I mean, just everyone asks you, why is Obama supporting Morsi? Why is the U.S. supporting the Brotherhood? It's an extremely difficult conversation to have because, I mean, it's not plausible to me. But most people are so convinced that it's self-evident that it's beyond discussion. I mean, my hunch, if I had to go either way, and it really is a hunch more than, you know, something that I would be able to demonstrate with footnotes or something, is that, you know, the U.S. is closer to the Egyptian military than it is to any other faction or element. I mean, we have very strong, longstanding training and arming and consultation with the military. And so it may be that the, you know, I would assume that there are conversations ongoing between either the State Department or the Defense Department or other elements of the U.S. and the high-ranking officers with whom we have very long-standing and presumably fairly close and cooperative relations. The American ambassador has become a distinctly unpopular figure. She was recently quoted saying that the protesters should show restraint, which was taken as a sign of American support for Morsi and the Brotherhood. So, you know, there is this conspiracy theory, and the conspiracy theory goes so far as to say that the U.S. and the Brotherhood plotted as early as 2008 and 2009 to instigate the uprising against Mubarak and install a Muslim Brotherhood government. So, I mean, that's the perception on the street. I find it unfortunate, but that's what it is.
Well, Dr. Sheila Karapiko, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sheila Karapiko, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, where she researches the political economy of development and with special emphasis on Arab countries. Recently, she was a visiting professor in the political science department at the American University of Cairo. She's the author of Political Aid, Democracy Promotion, and the Paradoxes of Empowerment. And her forthcoming book is Political Aid and Arab Activism, Democracy Promotion, Justice, and Representation. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about the doubling of student loans, the doubling of interest rates on student loans. My name, and I yearn.
with some issues that you can't believe. Single black female addicted to retail as well. And when it falls down, who you gonna call now? Come on, come on. And when it all falls down, man, I promise. And when it falls down, who you gonna call now? Come on, come on. And when it all falls down, man, I promise. I'm so
selfish. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Halperin, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and a senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He also has an article in the Huffington Post, Jury Award $13 million to Single Mom Deceived by For-Profit College Tied to Mitt Romney. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be back.
And obviously, I want to talk to you about the interest rates doubling from 3.4 to 6.8% on federal loans, set to go into effect tomorrow following the failure of the Congress to agree. But just let's touch on your article in the Huffington Post, because it's so outrageous. And we've spoken in the past about this for-profit college racket that I think is taking up about $60 to $80 billion of federal taxpayer money, charging them back to mostly minority students and vets at outrageous interest rates, giving them worthless diplomas and indenturing them for life. Now you have a Missouri jury awarding $13 million in punitive damages to a single mother who'd been deceived by one of these for-profit colleges owned and started by financed by Mitt Romney.
That's exactly right. She went to the college and said she wanted to be a nurse. They said, well, we don't have a nursing program, but we can put you on a fast track with a medical assistant degree. After she borrowed $27,000 to get her medical assistant degree, they said, oh, did we say medical assistant degree? We meant medical office assistant degree. You can be an office assistant. Really didn't need to go to college for that. They said to her that she could spend another $10,000 and she could become a medical assistant. She probably still couldn't transfer those credits to a legitimate nursing program, though. So she was very unhappy, and she sued, and there were articles about it and the fact that she stood up to the school that has systematically deceived students. But I remember the name of the school, Vatterott College, one of the schools that Mitt Romney's investment company advises people to invest in, a company started by his son, but where Mitt Romney is now chairman of the investment committee. So they're in business together. It was the same family of colleges, same owners, that Mitt Romney praised on the campaign trail when they asked him what he thought about education. He said for-profit colleges were good. Full Sail University was a wonderful school. It turned out he's one of the owners of Full Sail University. Anyway, I use Mitt Romney because he's a good hook to get people to pay attention to this issue. And this issue goes to the larger issue you mentioned of student loans. 25% of federal financial aid goes to these for-profit colleges. That's a large amount to be sucked up by schools, many of which, not all, but many, are a ripoff. But getting back to this question of the student loan interest rates, it is harder for people to pay for college in this world. And I went back and checked these statistics. In 1980, a federal Pell Grant paid for 75% of a public university education for a student, low-income student. Now those Pell Grants pay for about less than a third of such an education. State aid to education is down. So the question is, when we talk about how high the student loan interest rate should be, are we moving to a country where family wealth is really the main determinant of whether you can go to college and where you can go to college? And I fear that we are, and that's why I believe we should be keeping these interest rates low.
Well, the House, of course, passed a bill where they've tied rates to U.S. Treasuries with a cap of 8.5%. And the Senate, for example, Elizabeth Warren put forth a proposal to set rates at 0.75%, which is what big banks pay for money from the Federal Reserve. And that was her first standalone bill as this freshman senator, and that didn't even make it to the Senate floor. So where is the divide between the Democrats and the Republicans on this? I mean, clearly the Republicans have a higher cap than the Democrats, but no, except for Elizabeth Warren, nobody's talking about going back to the Pell Grants.
The Democrats are split. I mean, certainly we're in a situation where there's a federal government is short on revenues. We're trying to get closer to reducing the deficit. So they're thinking, well, how can we make money? We can make money loaning it to students for student loans. And that seems valid. But again, my principle is it is harder and harder for a person of modest means to pay for college in this country. There's a number of ways that we can basically redistribute income and wealth to make it easier for such people to go to college. One way is to have a lower interest rate. But again, because the government doesn't want to give away too much money at this point, it's not clear how much we are going to do in that regard. But I mean, if you take somebody like John Roberts, there's a conservative, the Chief Justice of the United States, he thinks America should be a meritocracy and people should be rise and fall based on their talents. Well, the one way to do that is to use some of our tax money to help lower-income people who are talented go to college, as opposed to just saying college is for rich kids.
Well, Elizabeth Warren, of course, said we should not be making money off the backs of our students. She's referring to the $51 billion in revenue that the federal government gets from the student loan program.
Right.
You know, so hers is obviously a minority voice here because her bill didn't even make it to the Senate floor. They have when they get back, I think, after the 4th, they have a chance of doing something, don't they? But again, you have this problem with the Senate versus the House, and the House feels anything comes from the Senate, the big brother is an imposition.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what the House will do. I just think that the president, who had some notion of a market approach to this, rather than a minimal interest rate, a subsidized interest rate, if you will, to help students, ought to stand up strong and say, this is a way that we can make a difference and move talented people into positions and careers that can help strengthen the country. And if we're not investing in young people and if we're only making it possible for the wealthy to attend elite colleges, then there's something wrong with the country. So I believe it's an investment we should make. Of course, the student loan system had to get fixed. Before, we were giving all the money to the banks. Students were paying higher rates, and all the profits were going to the banks for no good reason since they bore no risk. So at least we fixed the system now, and the federal government is the lender. But what we ought to do is, I mean, a 0% interest rate or a very low interest rate is subsidizing students, but we shouldn't be ashamed of that because that's what makes our country great is mobility and opportunity. That's what we should stand for. And if we're really just saying, gee, we can make some money off this now that we're in the student loan business, then I think we've kind of missed the point of why we're in the student loan business.
Again, I'm speaking with David Halperin, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president of the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Now, having been the counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee, obviously Dianne Feinstein was recently talking about, obviously she's made a number of statements about Edward Snowden, but your family has a pretty intimate experience of the government wiretapping. I recall back in the days of President Nixon, Henry Kissinger didn't he order the wiretapping of your father, who was on the National Security Council, Mort Halperin? And so did you as a family experience the intrusion of Big Brother on your life?
Well, a lot of people did. President Nixon wanted to know what the heck was going on, who was leaking. So a lot of journalists and a lot of government officials, or a relatively small number, were wiretapped, the logs were monitored by the White House to find out what was going on. I was a little boy living with my parents. Yes, they listened to our calls. We went to Santa Monica, actually, for a summer, and the family that rented our house, they were listening to their calls because they happened to be living in our house. So there was intrusion then, and there are intrusions now. Those wiretaps are ultimately judged to be unlawful. And now, of course, you've got in the wake of all this, we created a national security court, the FISA court, that the White House, that the Justice Department authorities are supposed to go to and ask for permission to listen in and monitor our calls and monitor our emails. But now we're seeing, as recently as today, new information about what goes on at that FISA court and what kind of things have been approved. So we're still in a world where we are being heavily monitored. Maybe there's a little bit more structure and a little bit less lawlessness associated with it, but I think there are still serious issues that we have to address about what's going on and whether we want the government to be able to listen to everything that we say and write to each other when we think that those things are private.
Well, David Halperin, all of those reforms, or so-called reforms, came in because of the abuses of Richard Nixon against your father and others that led to the Church Committee hearings and then led to the creation of the Senate and House Select Committees on Intelligence. But clearly a lot of people are unhappy about the extent to which we know what's going on. And people on those committees, there's a couple of dissidents, Senator Wyden, for example, who are frustrated because they know stuff they can't talk about. And you were counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. So that's a bit like being a eunuch in a harem, isn't it?
It depends, what your values are, what your concerns are. And I do think that if you're a member of that committee and you see things that are classified that you don't like, there are things you can do short of leaking the information to try to get things straight. You can bring in, which we used to do, top officials of the intelligence agencies behind closed doors and grill them. You can conduct your own investigation. We did one once, and I actually, as a very young lawyer, got to sit there and depose the head of the CIA, Bob Gates, and ask him questions about what had been going on with some actions by the CIA that we thought were not truthful and not appropriate. So there are things you can do. The intelligence committees are not entirely, in my experience, captive of the intelligence agencies. I think that they could be tougher, and there have been times when they were not as tough as they should be. But it is an important institution, the absence of which I think that we would be less honest. I mean, for years and years, so many of the things that we kept secret were not things that we were really hiding from our enemies. They were things that we were hiding from the American people because we didn't think that they would agree with them, and those would include, overthrows of democratically elected governments and attempts to assassinate foreign leaders. We just didn't want our citizens to have a debate about that. And I would say that's the same thing that's happening with the disclosures made by Mr. Snowden. Al-Qaeda is not going to be surprised to know that we can read their Facebook posts and their Gmail accounts. They know that we can do that. And I don't – whether they change their behavior in response to it, is up to them. But the classifying a program that says that we have access to phone records and Internet records is not to fool or outsmart Al-Qaeda. It's to avoid having a public debate about whether we should be doing those things. And that's not, to me, an appropriate use of classification. And whether or not Mr. Snowden is a hero or not and where how he should be treated, I think is I don't know. But I do know that some of the things that have been disclosed do not look like the kind of secrets in terms of their existence as opposed to how they're accomplished, that really the disclosure of which is going to harm national security. I don't really believe that, and I don't think that the NSA or the White House believes that.
Well, of course, the Europeans are furious, particularly the Germans, about revelations in Der Spiegel, presumably that came from Snowden via WikiLeaks, because WikiLeaks had an arrangement with Der Spiegel that the U.S. classifies them, the Germans, on the same level as Iraq and China, that the only countries that the NSA doesn't snoop on are Canada, Australia, Great Britain, and New Zealand because of the arrangement that they all have in sharing each other's signals intelligence. So that's certainly doing some damage, at least.
That's a harmful disclosure, no doubt. And I think there are legitimate reasons to classify that information.
And the president's finding that was publicized on the eve of the visit with the Chinese president, where it revealed a list of countries that Obama asked to be targeted for cyber attacks. That certainly undercut Obama's position with the Chinese leader.
Yes, I don't think that people who get paid to safeguard secrets and to work with secrets are heroes if they're just throwing the stuff out there. If there's real corruption, serious wrongdoing, the whole, you know, widespread abuses of human rights, those are the kind of things that I think a hero could be, someone could be a hero for blowing the whistle on, even if they breached a government duty. Now, maybe they should still have to pay a price of punishment for it, but I would say that person is a hero. But if you're just throwing stuff out there to be provocative or without really thinking about the consequences of it, you're not my hero.
Well, I've spoken to a couple of lawyers who represented at the Government Accountability Project, who represented some of the whistleblowers who were wrongly charged. They never took secrets out of the NSA, but they were held at gunpoint, and their careers were ruined. And these lawyers eventually got them exonerated, although they don't have their jobs back. And I asked the question, you know, where is there a place? They kept saying there's nowhere in the America we can come that's safe if you're a whistleblower. And Dianne Feinstein, the chair of this Senate Intelligence Committee, said that Snowden should have stayed here in the United States. So does he have that option? I mean, the idea that he's in the custody of or under the hospitality, shall we say, of the Russians is very troubling, given that they control that part of the airport where he supposedly is. And it looks like the longer they keep him, the more it's apparent that they're debriefing him. And now Putin is preparing the Russian press with long programs on how terrible the Americans are and all that stuff, which seems to be leading up to the possibility that Snowden will end up in Russia. And Russia is not exactly a sanctuary for human rights victims, you know.
I told you I think Putin is my least favorite person after Donald Trump, and I don't think it's not a model of anything positive, really, in terms of the government, in terms of Putin's government. So, again, the fact that Snowden might, you know, decide that that's the appropriate place to end up and to spill his secrets to, I don't respect, and it makes me wonder more about Snowden, which is not to say that I don't appreciate that we're having a debate about his disclosures of the fact that the government's just gobbling up all this data that includes all our information, because that's a concern. You know, when you read about what happened when offices had access to everybody's files, to celebrities' hospital records, celebrities' tax returns, it gets boring in the office. Eventually people open up and want to see Angelina Jolie's hospital records or the private emails of Kanye West or whatever. And so we don't want that temptation in the government's hands, even for fun, and we certainly don't want it for abuse. So I think it's good that we're now having a debate, however it happened and whoever Mr. Snowden is, about the ease with which government spies, government bureaucrats can look at all our information, monitor our traffic in whatever form. It seems to me that if they know of a terrorist, if they know of particular patterns of terrorism and other threats to our security, they should be able to go in and target that and request that data, but not just have all the stuff at their fingerprints. I just think that is 1984. That is a society that is subject to serious abuses by government. You know, a lot of us love Obama. Or we love, other people in the Obama administration. We think Eric Holder's a nice guy. I know that he is. But I don't necessarily want to worry about who the next guy is and what that person might do, or that John Ashcroft in the hospital might decide to go with the bigger, stronger guys instead of the guy that's telling him to do the right thing.
Well, just in closing, what then do we make of Senator Feinstein's admonition to Edward Snowden that he shouldn't have left the United States, that he should have gone public here? Does the mechanism exist for them? Because, you know, whistleblowers end up getting creamed, and inspector generals tend not to stand up for the people they're supposed to be protecting.
Well, I think there has been harsh treatment of whistleblowers, and I think the administration may probably push too hard. They've certainly gone too hard, in my view, against journalists. But I do think that, if he really believed he was doing the right thing, then the more responsible thing to do would be to take the punishment. He took on a government job. He accepted the security clearance and air his grievances in a public trial and potentially, you know, serve time for it, rather than do what he's doing now, which is saying, well, you know, I'll run around, I'll make it a more romantic thing. But ultimately, if what he's doing is debriefing the Russians, a more corrupt, a more abusive government, he isn't really doing much for the world. So I think it's a difficult choice. I don't know everything that happened in his life and everything that's going on, but I can understand what Senator Feinstein's saying is, it's not, you're no hero if you're appearing with Putin and getting a beautiful place to live in Russia and being treated as a hero there for doing something, at the hands of a government that is much worse than ours.
Well, David Halpern, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much, Ian. Talk to you soon.
Again, thank you. Again, I've been speaking with David Halpern, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president of the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back getting an analysis of the just-passed Senate immigration bill.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Antonio Gonzalez, the president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, which, founded in 1974, is the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voting participation organization in the United States. During the first dozen years of Gonzalez's tenure at the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, he's doubled Latino registration from 5.5 million in 1994 to more than 10 million registrants in 2006. And increased Latino voting from nearly 5 million to over 11 million between 1994 and 2012. In 2005, Time magazine named Antonio Gonzalez one of the 25 most influential Hispanics in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Antonio Gonzalez.
It's good to be with you, Ian. I wish I could get you to introduce me every time I talk on the radio.
Well, you know, we're kind of ships that pass in the night, because I follow you on the air on Mondays. So it's good to have a conversation with you, because we barely get a chance to say hello.
Ditto.
Yeah. So tell me, though, about this bill that's the so-called Gang of Eight are being, you know, praise is being heaped upon them. Even the president called from Africa. People are talking about this exercise in bipartisanship that drove an $8 billion bill up to $40 billion for additional border security that one of the bill's sponsors, Senator Corker, called overkill. So now, of course, the House is saying it's dead on arrival. So what are we celebrating here?
Well, we are not celebrating, Ian. There is a host of leadership across the country that is very unhappy with the Senate immigration reform bill, and for the right reasons, hopes that it doesn't get enacted. There's a lot of people in the country, mostly on the far right, for the wrong reasons, that hope an immigration bill is not enacted. But this bill is really a boondoggle for the military-industrial complex, militarizing the U.S.-Mexico border unnecessarily. The border, actually, according to statistics, is the safest place in the country, and Homeland Security has already classified the border as secure, with no net in migration from Mexico, for example, for the last 4 years. So this is overkill, and I can go further about the immigration legalization fraud that is being perpetrated as well. It's basically a 30% legalization masquerading as a 11 million person legalization. It's quite a mess.
Well, I spoke recently with the mayor of Laredo, Texas, and across the border, Nuevo Laredo is one of the most dangerous towns or cities in Mexico. And they only had one murder last year. And he also said that El Paso is the safest city in America. So what's all this talk about the border being so unsafe and needing all this extra billions of dollars worth of security?
Well, it's a spin that's been perpetrated. You know, a lot of it has to do with just, frankly, lack of information or disinformation with the English-speaking public that, you know, see B-roll from 20 years ago and think that there's hordes of, you know, Latin American immigrants storming the southern border. Nothing could be further from the truth. On the one hand, you know, the backdrop has, of this immigration reform is, you know, sort of the slowly but surely demographic transformation of America, and the social composition of the average immigrant has transformed over the last two generations as well. They're no longer, although there are European immigrants, most immigrants are from the developing world, and that, you know, pulls at the consciousness of that sector of the country that still sees America as a European hegemonic ethno-racial country, and that's changing. And immigration is part of that change. It's a small part of that change, but it's a very obvious part of that change. So that's part of the context too. People resisting immigration reform because they want America to stay a white country, but they're two generations late.
So the there, of course, there's a lot of lobbying going on here, and the sausage making sort of indicates to me how politics really operate in this country, where the liberals basically keep giving things up in order to get some bipartisanship, and you end up with this monstrosity. I mean, the same thing happened when Obama first started with the stimulus because the economy was flat on its back because of the crash of Wall Street. Compromise, compromise, compromise. You end up with something that doesn't really do the job, and we're still you know, barely recovering. Otherwise, had we had a full-throated stimulus, we wouldn't have the problems we have today. The same with the health care bill. Compromise, compromise, compromise in order to get the bipartisanship. So all of this idea of bipartisanship, to me, all it is moving the goalposts to the right.
Yeah, I think we use the wrong word when we say it's a compromise. These are essentially, a better word would be surrender or concession, because there really isn't something that's being had on the liberal side. There's no, you can't really point to, of the, in the thousand pages, there are perhaps two or three programs that progressives or just liberals, would say that's a good program, and 100 elements in there that are really quite punitive. It may be that we're playing just a cynical game here, Ian. That is, Democrats are positioning to blame Republicans and seek to use it in the election campaign. More 2016 than 2014. That may be the real kabuki theater that's unfolding here. Of course, it's like any plan. Once you get into battle, the plan goes to hell because reality intervenes. And the border surge is one example of that. What's really behind the border surge is the military-industrial complex making up for its lost profits due to the cutbacks in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the sequester. And the timing is almost, it's very precise. Sequester hits, and the lobby migrates to the immigration reform bill as the target of opportunity through Republicans. They begin to, you know, say how terrible it is on the border. Give me another $10 billion, then $20 billion, now $30 billion more. But I want to be clear, it's not just Republicans. I mean, who drives this is Chuck Schumer, the senator, and very ambitious senior senator from New York, who has transformed over the last 10 years since September 11th into a hawk. And now he's become an immigration hawk. So the border surge, that wasn't written by the Republicans. The border surge was written by Chuck Schumer.
Right, and he's the guy, by the way, that protects the hedge fund managers and the Wall Street billionaires by keeping the carried interest rate at 15%. So those guys pay less tax than their secretaries do.
That's correct.
And he's now saying that by the end of the year, the House will pass a Senate bill. Trey Gowdy, the Republican from South Carolina in the House Judiciary Committee, says the Senate bill is not going to pass in the House. It's not going to pass for a myriad of reasons, and that the House will pass its own bill in pieces, which will be tougher on enforcement and border security than the Senate bill, which is hardly possible. Nancy Pelosi is saying immigration reform is necessary for Republicans if they ever want to win. Why is she telling them what to do here? I mean, isn't that what you're saying here, that they're on a course of political suicide? So, and that's what the subtext is.
You know, I don't believe in any of that. Uh-huh. I got to tell you, if you're looking at the 2014 cycle, Republicans are not in a bad place. Their districts do not have, there's not a way in their districts to have a strong immigration lobby today, because redistricting made them very conservative, safe districts. So their bases are telling them to fight. And so resisting immigration reform for the House of Representatives is not a problem for 2014. Regarding 2016, anybody that claims to know what's going to have, I mean, they should go play the lottery, because they're pretty smart and lucky. I don't claim to know what's going to happen in 2016. At this time in the 2008 cycle, which would be 2005, no one even had heard of Barack Obama, right? I mean, people thought Hillary was a lock. That's what it was. Obama was beginning to emerge. No one thought that he had a chance against Hillary. So I really don't know what's going to happen in 2016. I didn't expect George Bush to take Al Gore in 2000, mm-hmm. If we're in 1997 trying to prognosticate. So I think part of the big problem here is the architecture of this bill. Omnibus bills are the single hardest thing to get done in the American Congress in the postmodern period. And you just wonder if, for twisted reasons, the Republicans don't have a point about going incrementally. It's just easier to get done. Of course, they want to pass evil increments, and what you want to do is pass positive and effective increments. But I just think sometimes that this stubborn resistance or stubborn fealty to an omnibus comprehensive immigration reform architecture in practice has been proven to be a failure. And hopefully, I agree with the House Republicans. I don't think the Senate bill has a chance in hell. I think we're looking at, everyone's going to fight, and then this thing will die in conference at the end of the year. And I hope that somebody, I know we're certainly trying to figure out how to pick up the pieces and get at least something done before we get into the 2014 cycle. If not, then we're looking at a 2015 fight again.
But of course, the gerrymandering in the House doesn't apply to the Senate races. They have to run on a statewide basis. So presumably, that issue of alienating the largest growing demographic group in the country. I mean, I think that's why Adam Liptak in the New York Times did a long piece on Chief Justice Roberts, suggesting in a way that he is the greatest strategist the Republicans have. You know, his getting rid of the Voting Rights Act will allow them in the next cycle to steal as many minority votes as they can possibly do. But at the same time, liberalizing on same-sex marriage is helping the Republicans enter the 21st century. And the arguments you hear about Latino voters embracing the Latino vote is not that we love Latinos, it's that we better stop pissing them off.
Well, again, one has to look at the difference between an off-year election and a presidential election. I would expect, and this holds true for the Senate, if you look at the Senate in 2014, those Democrats, there's about four of them, that were up for that will be up for a re-election in 2014 did not support the or only supported the Senate bill after the border surge got on. They were no votes, and they came back because of the border surge.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of the country is divided. I think we have to acknowledge that it's divided. And when you have low turnout like you have in off-year races, the right-wing share, the conservative share, grows, and that's why they're able to continue to win. And I would expect in 2014 that the Republicans will do very well in both the House and the Senate. 2016, when you have big turnouts of people of color and young people, that's when Democrats tend to gain. Now, and I don't think this logic will change. I think it has to change, but that would mean a fundamental reform of American
right.
political process, the well, longer conversation.
Sure.
It won't change in 14 or 16.
Right.
Hence, you know, we have a better shot
right.
in pressuring for immigration reform in 15 as the presidential's approach. This is when the Hispanic vote is dangerous. And in 17, if you have a Democratic victory.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Antonio Gonzalez, why has the United States taken this peculiar and punitive path? You know, now they're ladling it with pork barrel. You know, the European Union basically has open borders, and it would seem to me that if we had an open border with Mexico and with Canada, which we largely have at any rate, you would have a situation where people could come back and forth from their home countries, and if you had legal means of having visas back and forth, that would solve the problem better than a fence, which all that does is criminalize the border. People pay thousands of dollars to coyotes. That seems inhuman as well as criminal. I just don't understand why we have taken this approach and not had a more enlightened approach of a more open border as opposed to a closed one.
Well, the European analogy is instructive, I think. Europe got to that point of open borders only after, you know, centuries of conflict. And the United States is still in that phase of conflict with the developing Latin American countries to the south, and you add the racial backdrop, and I think that's really the understanding. We're an immature culture and country in that regard. I think we'll get there as Latin America continues to develop, and as the, you know, sort of Europe versus old Europe versus the developed versus the colonies ethos, you know, works its way out of American culture through time. But in the meantime, and you're correct, it would be better to have a North American visa system, for example. Dr. Hinojosa from UCLA has explored that concept, have the market decide, labor go back
yeah.
and forth, wages will equalize,
well,
and so
yeah.
forth.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid we're out of time, Antonio.
We could go on and on.
I thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Antonio Gonzalez, who's president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, which was founded in 1974. During his tenure, he doubled Latino registration from 5.4 million in 1994 to more than 10 million and increased Latino voting by nearly 5 million to over 11 million from 1994 to 2012. And Time magazine named him in 2005 one of the 25 most influential Hispanics in America. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.